This is Report to Wyoming.
Our guest today is Chad Hansen. He is a sociology professor at the college. He is also a writer, a poet, and a photographer, among many other things. I was delighted to talk to him today about the wild horses of Wyoming. Okay, so you're from Minnesota, but what brought you to Wyoming?
My wife and I moved to Casper in 2001, so we've been here for a solid couple of decades, and we mostly moved.
Where were you before that?
Before that, I had taught at a college in Wisconsin for about 4 years. I lived in Arizona for a long time. I went to school in Flagstaff at Northern Arizona University, and then in Tucson at the U of A, University of Arizona. So I was in Arizona for about a decade.
Okay, and it sounds like your wife was not a Casper girl.
She is not. She was originally from California, and she and I met.
Oh, okay. So when did your interest in wild horses really take off?
My interest in wild horses started in about the year 2012. I had lived in Casper in Wyoming for about a decade before I even knew that we had wild horses. Turns out that I've been seeing them on drives and on the sides of roads, but I didn't know that that's what they were. It wasn't until about 2012 that I discovered that Wyoming is home to several areas where wild horses live on public land.
Okay. I remember my first time seeing wild horses was when I was a kid, or knowing that they were wild horses, I should say, driving to Rock Springs. I'm from southwest Wyoming, so that was our closest Walmart. We'd make the two-hour trip south, and that's the first time that someone pointed out, hey, those horses are wild. And once you know that, you can start to see there are markers, right? Tangled hair sometimes. The hooves aren't as groomed. They have distinctions, right?
They do. You're right. Nobody's out there grooming these horses. They get long manes. They get what appear to be dreadlocks. They get gnarls, and their manes get covered with burrs and sage. And I happen to like it. I think wilder the better.
It is very cool. I agree. What can you tell us about the history that you've learned about how these animals got to Wyoming?
It's a fascinating history. Actually, the oldest horse fossils on Earth were discovered in Wyoming over near a spot just outside of Kemmerer. Horses have about a 55-million-year history right here in North America and in Wyoming in particular. They actually evolved in the West, and scientists still face a bit of a mystery when it comes to when or how horses went extinct in North America. There's some pretty good evidence that horse numbers shrank, and then maybe they disappeared altogether about 5,000 years ago. We have a clear fossil record of their evolution. But then the fossil record goes cold. We have some DNA evidence that puts them here about 5,000 years ago. And then the trail picks up again about 500 years ago with the arrival of Spanish horses brought across from Europe on the ships of explorers.
I imagine that's a pretty big part of their evolution. And then just in the last few hundred years, because humans were so finite that it's hard to think about 5,000 years ago. What's the evolution been like maybe in the last four generations?
Recent history, it's interesting. Horses in the wild, they choose their own mates. And they're a little bit like us. They have preferences for what kind of families they create and what kind of partners they choose. And so they've been selecting themselves. And all the evidence suggests that they've been selecting for traits that suit the West. They're small, rugged, strong. Endurance is incredible. They're hardy. They can make it through Wyoming winters on their own, not always, but they succeed in places where other animals couldn't.
As far as selection goes, do you notice any color trends? Or there's such a vast array of, you know, the different coats that they have.
There are. And we notice some differences as you drive around Wyoming. There are herds that have a high number of pintos, for example. In some of the areas that we visit closer to Casper, like Green Mountain, for instance, we find some bloodlines where there are a lot of dappled gray horses in an area just south of Green Mountain called Stewart Creek, north and northwest of Rawlins. We have wild Appaloosas, which is a unique situation. Not every state has Appaloosas in their wild herds, but Wyoming does, and some of them are close to home, not too far from Casper.
Oh, I love Appaloosas. They have such a unique pattern sometimes, and those dots, and if they get a circle on their eye, or I wonder if there's any lore around that, or even like cultural significance to Wyoming.
There is. The Appaloosa was the preferred horse of the Nez Perce tribe. So we have every reason to believe that the wild Appaloosas in Wyoming are probably holed over from some of the breeding practices of the Nez Perce and then some of the trades that took place between the tribes back when they controlled large parts of the plains.
Okay, and horses historically as a commodity, that might have shifted their evolution too because, well, now we talk about domestication, but if we're talking about native tribes, some of those horses might have been domesticated but then released or they maybe escaped.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the tribes just understood that they had large groups of wild horses to choose from. When they needed a horse, they could round one up and then gentle that horse and make it part of their herd.
Okay. And then, yeah, I was thinking when I said commodity there, just about how certain unique horses, colorings, patterns, markings, those might appeal to people, whereas they might not appeal to other horses, right?
That's right. When it comes time to adopt wild horses, for example, we find that pintos are more easily adopted. People like the variety of colors. Some of the horses that are either black or more plain looking, we do have a harder time, the BLM has a harder time adopting those horses out.
I noticed even my daughters when we were looking through the book that you were nice enough to send to us, and we'll get to that so people know where they can find it too, but they immediately gravitated towards the white horses. The all white, there's something kind of ethereal about them.
There is, yeah. In Wyoming, there's a wide range of herd areas that have big, robust white stallions, beautiful white mares. Oh, there's a lot to see.
It's got to be kind of magical or even spooky if you're out in the wild and just an all white horse appears. And then I think of pop culture and Lord of the Rings and the Gandalf significance, etc. But it's definitely really cool to see that we have those.
It is. And there is a long history of white horses appearing in folklore and even spiritual and religious traditions. Horses have prominent place in a lot of our wisdom traditions and spiritual practices, but maybe white horses in particular stand out, right?
I think for our listeners, it would be fun for you to describe your field research on the subject and how you get your photographs.
Sure. I am a sociologist by training, so one of the first things that appealed to me about wild horses is that they are incredibly social. They're beautiful to look at. It's hard to take a bad picture of a horse. And so there was that, of course. It's just fun to spend time with them. But as I spent more time observing their behavior in the field, what I noticed is that, first of all, they live in very closely knit family bands. Sometimes as small as two or three horses, sometimes as large as 12 or 14 horses together in a single band. And then more recently, there's been research with aerial drones. We have teams of researchers around the world who are studying herds of wild horses with drones. and they're actually using the phrase multi-leveled societies to describe the relations that horses form when they're left to themselves out in the wild. So back to my own observations, I've taken some of those cues, the idea that horses live in multi-leveled societies, and we're starting to tease out some of the more particulars of the arrangements. Family bands, those are the most basic units, but wild horses probably also form larger bonded groups, very likely what we call extended clans, and then subpopulations within a herd. So there's all kinds of varying degrees of social networks and social relations that they form out on the range. And as a social scientist, that's exciting to me. It's the social aspect of horse life that keeps me out there on the range.
Are horses monogamous?
To a degree, they live in families where they have one, sometimes two stallions, and then what biologists call a harem of mares. So anywhere between one and a dozen or even more mares per family.
Okay, so that would be the family unit then, or you're calling it a band?
Yeah, a band or a family. I use those words interchangeably.
And what's maybe an average, if we could, lifespan for a wild horse?
In the wild, an old wild horse would be 20.
Okay, that's pretty good.
It's good. Yeah, domestic horses can live longer than that, but on the range, on their own, if a horse lives to be 20, that would be old age.
What kind of natural deaths do these horses have?
Oh, they succumb to a lot of forces. Winters are tough on wild horses. They don't always survive tough winters. The late winter and spring of 2023 was especially tough on some of our horse herds. If listeners remember, that's when we had multiple snowstorms, one after the other, in the late part of the year. So the weather is sometimes tough on horses. In some herd areas, mountain lions prey on wild horses, foals in particular. And we've seen evidence where adult horses have survived lion attacks, and it's obvious because of the scars that they bear, mostly on their hind quarters. And wild stallions in particular sometimes injure one another during skirmishes. And injuries that result when stallions fight can sometimes cost a wild horse their life.
They're obviously not as prominent as our deer and other game. And I just say that because you don't ever hear people hitting a wild horse. I'm sure it happens, but it's not like people, if you live in Wyoming long enough, you definitely know somebody who's hit a deer, right?
Right. Yeah, wild horses only live in 16 places in Wyoming. So their territory it's not as vast as you find with other species. Antelope count the whole state of Wyoming as their habitat, but wild horse habitat is pretty limited to select areas. And when you do come across them, it's nearly always on dirt roads, sometimes two tracks. So they aren't the same kind of threat that you find on a highway where you might encounter a mule deer or an antelope.
Okay. Oh, and then before we move on, I just thought it was interesting. The last time we chatted, you talked about how during your summers, I believe, that's when you camp out and you take a lot of your pictures. And I just thought that was really cool. How many summers have you spent doing this?
Well, let me count. We started in 2012, so we're a good solid dozen summers in.
And it's him and his wife, right? Just going and camping.
My wife, Linda, and I. We have a canvas teepee that we pitch out on the range. It was manufactured right here in Casper by a great outfit called Kistler Tent and Awning. It's about 9 foot tall and about 9 foot square at the bottom, so we have plenty of room for two cots and then all our other camping gear. We pitch our teepee usually in places where we know we can expect to find wild horses, and it's a great way to wake up in the morning. There's been a lot of occasions where we step out of the tent, sit down in our chair next to our camp table, have a cup of coffee, and watch wild horses, even if it's through binoculars. a good way to start your day.
And I'm sure you see a lot of other wildlife as well.
We do. Yeah, in the Red Desert where we watch horses, there's a resident herd of elk. There are antelope. We see raptors. We've found badgers, big jackrabbits. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot to see.
Mm. And is it always Wyoming, or do you travel around?
We love Wyoming, and most of our travels and camping trips are within the state. But my wife and I also visit Nevada to see both their wild horses and their wild burros.
Mm.
We also travel to Arizona sometimes. Arizona probably has more wild donkeys than any other state, and there's very few things that I like as well as wild horses, but wild donkeys are right there in the same category. Fun to watch.
We've got plenty of time, so I do want to ask about that. What's the difference between a burro and a donkey?
I use those two terms as I see them as one and the same.
Okay.
Talking about the same species.
All right, and a donkey. I used to have a very ornery donkey named Evie growing up, by the way. Her original name was Nancy, but that's my mother's name, so we changed it. But donkeys are a combination of a horse and a mule, right?
Nope. A mule is a combination of a horse and a donkey.
Oh, that's okay. Such a fun picture. Like, how does that work? And then the mules are sterile.
That's correct, yeah. When a horse and a donkey have a foal, that foal is unable to reproduce.
But you do see mules in the wild as well, right?
Not as often. Yeah, a mule in the wild would be a pretty rare occurrence. And
okay.
Because they don't reproduce, it would have to be a situation where maybe a mule was turned out onto public land.
Oh, gotcha.
But that's not too common. Mostly in the herds that we visit, you find either populations of wild burros, or in the case of the Wyoming herds, all we have in here in Wyoming are wild horses. We don't actually have any populations of wild donkeys here.
Okay, that makes sense. And then I wonder, just spitballing, it would probably be very rare for a horse and a donkey to naturally mate. Do you think that's maybe why that it's mules are really the product of human intervention?
Most of the time, yeah, that's right. There are a handful of places on public lands in the West where wild horses and wild burros might intermix and possibly produce a mule. I'm thinking of maybe one, for sure one, possibly two herds in Arizona where that could happen.
Hmm.
But otherwise, these two animals stay pretty separate.
Now, this topic, whenever we write about it or there's the roundups or whatever, we get a lot of comments. People have strong opinions about wild horses, as it turns out. Some of the concerns that we hear are that wild horses can limit the growth of other species, elk, deer, and bighorn sheep, or that they can deplete water and food resources that those animals and ranchers need. Have you thought about any counterarguments to those or solutions, if you have any, when it comes to wild horses?
Yeah, I'll gladly talk about some solutions, but maybe before I do, I would express a little bit of skepticism. I know that there are limited resources on the range, but I already mentioned that wild horses are actually limited when it comes to where they can even live. So we're actually talking about pretty small parts of Wyoming to begin with. And I think some of the competition between wild horses and other species is maybe overstated. For example, I've heard some urban legends that wild horses can be bullies and they may even scare other species away from waterholes. But that has not been our experience. In fact, we have still photos and video footage where wild horses and other animals drink side by side at waterholes. I was even able to document a situation where a wild colt, after having been kicked out of his family of origin, joined a band of elk and became an elk for part of the summer because they're so social. So the kind of antagonism that people sometimes imagine between horses and other species, that just hasn't been borne out in our research. That said, there is a limited amount of space and a limited amount of resources on public land. So my wife and I created a nonprofit called the Wyoming Mustang Institute. And in part, we created the organization to help advocate for humane, effective, and affordable fertility control for wild horses, in particular wild mares. And the Bureau of Land Management has done a really good job in some of the herds darting wild mares to limit the number of foals that are born in spring. And that way, once we decide what the right population of wild horses is for a given area, we can set that number and keep it roughly stable by using fertility control.
And in what kind of boardrooms are these conversations being had? Who's making the decisions on what a controlled population is? What is that number? Who's deciding that?
Well, that's a bit of a mystery. The BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, is charged with making that decision. They call the appropriate number, use an abbreviation called AML, which stands for appropriate management level. So they set the AML, or the appropriate number, for every herd. And exactly how the Bureau arrives at that number is the source of some debate and a lot of mystery. The National Academy of Sciences did a big review of the Horse and Burro program in 2013. That's the last time they did a thorough review of the program, and one of their conclusions was that we just don't have a good idea how that number is set.
When I think about the positives, it's obvious to me that horses are such a huge symbol of the American West and our heritage. And then I've also heard arguments about fire mitigation. The same could be said about bison, which were native to the land as well. What other pros can you think of?
On my end, I'm a social scientist, so I think a lot about the impact of wild horses on people. I teach a class, for example, called the Wild Horse Experience, and it involves a couple days of discussion on the Casper College campus, and then we have a field trip that we take. We go out into the public lands west of Casper to look for wild horses, and semester after semester, year after year, I've been able to see what kind of impact horse watching has on people. It's uplifting. And in part of my research from my last couple of books, I've gone through some of the studies on how charismatic megafauna like horses and really nature and natural scenery in general, how those things impact mental health. And it's positive. There's all kinds of reasons for people to get outside and to take advantage of some of the places and some of the wildlife that we have to see in Wyoming.
Now, if somebody was on a camping trip and came across some wild horses, would you say it's advisable not to try to pet them? Or any other recommendations you have?
Petting is out 100%. No can do. Actually, there's pretty strict what we call wild horse etiquette. And as far as the Bureau of Land Management is concerned, you're really not supposed to approach wild horses at a distance any closer than about 300 feet. So with a good zoom lens on your camera, that still allows for some pretty incredible photography. But for the horse's sake, it's best to keep it a fair distance.
And I think that really applies to all animals, but I always like to throw in a safety a little.
There's a constant temptation, I know. It's tempting to want to pet them, but it's not advised.
Right. And petting horses is so normalized in our, you know, because there are so many domestic horses that there might be the assumption there that they're, that they are tame, when in fact, no.
They're not. Yeah. And if someone was to try to pet a wild horse, my hunch is that they would flee. Their instinct when it comes to the standard fight or flight response that animals have, and frankly that we all have, horses' first instinct is to run. That's their primary defense. They're fast, and they make use of their speed. So the most you would do is probably scare them off, but it would also interrupt their natural behavior. And the really fascinating thing about wild horses is to watch and observe their natural behavior. And that, of course, that's best done at a distance.
Now, with the remainder of our time, I want to talk about the books that you've put together. Is this your second book?
My most recent book is my second book on wild horses. That's right.
In
2022, I wrote one called In a Land of Awe. That is a work of nonfiction. And then most recently, I have a new book out. It'll actually start shipping in March, but advanced copies have been sent to select media outlets and personalities like yourself. It's called The Wild Horse Effect, and the subtitle is Awe, Well-Being, and the Transformative Power of Nature. It's a coffee table book. It's full of color photographs. And then I wrote an introductory essay to each chapter. And the book contains a lot of lengthy captions. I used the captions in the book to explain as much as I could, or to try to convey all of what I've learned about wild horses, their intelligence, their behavior, their social networks. I've tried to share as much as I've learned over the last few years.
Wow, and there's probably thousands of pictures in this book, right?
Oh, not thousands, but I think close to 200.
I'm exaggerating.
I think we landed at just under 200.
Oh, okay. But then you've definitely taken thousands of pictures.
I have taken thousands of pictures. I have hard drives upon hard drives full of digital photos. It's true.
And I wonder, as you return to the same spots year after year, or maybe you're traveling to different spots, but do you ever return to a spot and see familiar horses, or kind of get to know them, if you will?
We do. Yeah, we see many of the same horses, if not week after week, then month by month. And we use some techniques to not just get to know the horses, but to let them get to know us. Like, for example, I wear roughly the same clothes each time I go out so that horses can get accustomed to my big floppy sun hat. And we found that that technique works when horses have great memories. So when they see you once, and then they see you again, and they see you another time, once they start to see you on multiple occasions, they start to get accustomed to you, and they start to realize that you're not a threat. And that helps us get a little closer, and it helps with our photography.
Do any of them have individual quirks?
They do. They do. We used to know a horse called we called him Tuffy, because he was a little bit cantankerous. He was kind of a rascally stallion who liked to challenge some of the other horses in his wider herd. There are some stallions that we've come to know as just really incredible parents. They're just doting fathers. They do a lot to help the mares and the raising of their foals. And of course, one of the main characteristics of wild mares is that they really are incredibly attentive to their young ones. Mares and foals are almost inseparable for about the first year of life. So we get to see some of those personality traits when we're out there in the field.
Oh, I love that. You're like the Jane Goodall of Wyoming wild horses.
I'll take that as a compliment. Yeah, Jane Goodall is one of my heroes.
And that's interesting because she talks about their quirks, but of course primates are so human-like, it's probably a little easier to spot those things because we see those traits in ourselves.
It's true. One of my favorite quotes is from a book I was made to read in high school. Probably a lot of your listeners had to read The Catcher in the Rye.
J.D. Salinger.
And the main character in the book, Holden Caulfield, once said, "At least horses are human, for crying out loud." When I read that for the first time, I thought, yeah, isn't that right? A lot of the things that we appreciate in each other, affection, loyalty, attention to family, horses have all those same traits, except actually turned up a few notches. I think Salinger was right. Maybe they're even more human than we are.
This has been Report to Wyoming, presented in the public interest by Town Square Media.